The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Common Ground Meditation Center. So most of you know, usually once a month we invite a visiting teacher or senior community member to speak about the practice to the community. Fortunate to have Steve Hagen here tonight. I know many of you have practiced at Dharmafield or gone to talk there. It's in southwest Minneapolis, a beautiful Zen center. And Steve is the founder and the head teacher there at Dharmafield. And he's also a well-known Buddhist author. And some of you have seen his books or read his books. They're quite nice. I've read a couple of them myself. Meditation Now or Never, I haven't read. It's the new book, I guess, came out a year and a half or so ago. And that's also the title for tonight's talk. He's also written the book, Buddhism Is Not What You Think, and Buddhism Plain and Simple. And then there was a first book, which was Theory of Everything. I know that's not the title, but what was it?
How the World Can Be the Way It Is.
How the World Can Be the Way It Is. I recently gave it to Ajahn Punadamo. He just sent me an email. He really liked it. I don't know if you know him. He's a monk up in Canada, by Thunder Bay.
Good.
So we're very happy to have you here tonight, Steve. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
So we'll have a talk and then maybe a discussion or questions and answers. And then please stay for reception afterward if you'd like.
Good evening. Good to see you. I guess I'm supposed to talk about meditation now or never. Well, I will say a little bit about meditation as I've learned it excuse me, from my teacher, and I've practiced it now for many years. Well, here at Common Ground, you practice Vipassana, right? Yeah. So this would be a little different, perhaps, than what you're familiar with, what I'm going to say. Basically, what I want to talk about is the uselessness of meditation. And normally that strikes people as being a little odd. But that's the kind of meditation we do. It's the kind of meditation I teach. It's absolutely useless. We don't use it for anything. Of course, there's many different kinds of meditation that people take up, and sometimes just for relaxation, sometimes maybe visualization to help you with various things. And Or just calming yourself, centering yourself, relaxing. But the meditation that I learned from my teacher is it's not that it's not these things, it could be. But it's really just simply about this matter of just being present here. And it has nothing really to do, as one of our teachers in our school, Dogen Zenji, who brought Soto Zen to Japan in the 13th century, he's often quoted in our teachings. And he said Sanzen, which is Zazen, or sitting meditation, done correctly or properly, he says it has nothing to do actually with sitting or lying down, he said. And so this is to carry out meditation properly. This, he calls it Sanzen. It is just simply to be here. But if you're here for some purpose, some reason to get something, to become relaxed or centered or enlightened or whatever, then you're not really here. You're engaged in something. Your mind is somewhere else. Trying to bring about a particular state or whatever. And as we understand it in our teaching, if you look very carefully at that, you'll see that that's kind of a, in a sense, a disturbed mind. It may be a very settled mind in many ways. But there's still some disturbance there. There's some wanting, some greediness is still latent in the mind. Even if you want this for a very good reason, for altruistic reasons or whatever, whatever your reason is, still doing it for some reason, some purpose. And as Dogen and as my teacher taught, and as I now understand and try to point out to people, this still isn't being present here. This is still seeing your life caught up in self, as an expression of self. When self is present, then within our experience, when this is kind of the focal point of it all, well, then there is this wanting. There's also this other kind of disturbance. Sometimes we call it anger or aversion. Because if we desire some particular thing, even if it's some wonderful state of mind, with that desire that is there, well, the mind, if we observe it very carefully, it keeps changing. It doesn't, at least our personal mind certainly does. It oscillates and changes. And whatever it is that we might think we're going to try to achieve or to get or to gain through this meditation, sooner or later, it's going to be thwarted. Oh, maybe we can regain whatever it was that we thought we were looking for. But then that dies away once again. We can't really hang on to that. And with that, very often we become disturbed, we become angry, we become upset in some way. Maybe grossly, or maybe in very subtle ways. So this matter then of just settling down, just being here, it is not something that we can set out to do. Because in our very setting out to do this, to accomplish this, to gain this, is already to engage the very mind that the meditation has dropped. We to be in the meditation. So we have to understand this, and we have to understand this thoroughly. But this is not something that is easily understood because it just runs so counter to everything that we do, everything that we've learned, everything that that seems important to us. We would take up anything our whole life long. Everybody we've known, really, what do? We take up things usually with some purpose in mind. Maybe not always, but very often, I mean, that's where we are. So we'll come to meditation with the same kind of idea. I certainly did. My life seemed to be, I don't know, just a little bit too agitated, a little bit too disturbed, very unsettled in many ways. Also, there was this notion of enlightenment out there too. I thought that sounded pretty good. And maybe I can find that. And that's not an unusual way to approach this. Very common. But finally, when I met a good teacher, started pointing out this matter, that this is useless. Nothing to gain from this. And at first I didn't understand this. I know sometimes when people encounter this kind of teaching, they think, well, if it's useless, well, thanks very much for letting me know. No, I don't have to bother with it. I'll go on to something else that's more useful. But in my case, by the time I encountered this sort of teaching, I had kind of hit the end of my rope. And also I noticed that, well, here, this guy that's telling me this, he practices meditation every day, and he's done this for many years. Why would he do that? And so I understood that I had got the impression that there was something very subtle going on here that was being pointed out. And I also realized that I probably wasn't going to understand it anytime soon. But I began to do then what my teacher did. And he would speak of meditation for the long run. meditation not as something that you would just pick up every now and then, maybe to relax you. I mean, these practices are perfectly fine. I don't mean to disparage them in any way. There are techniques you can use to just sit down very quickly to become relaxed and settled, and that's perfectly fine. But this matter of really settling down and really being here, being present, being awake and aware of what is really taking place here, this is another matter altogether. And it isn't something that comes very easily or very quickly. It isn't something you can just pick up, use for a bit, and then drop, go on with your day or whatever. You're talking about something else altogether here. And so my teacher would talk about meditation then for the long run. And for this, he pointed out that basically three things. This is something I always talk about whenever I talk about meditation. I always want to point these three things out. Meditation for the long run, first of all, is the most important thing to remember. If you want to take up meditation as a practice in life, you know, practice for life, one thing you need to understand, this is absolutely vital, and that is that you have to practice this meditation on a regular basis. And what I mean by that is that it doesn't mean that you sit every day and if you miss one, all of a sudden everything's out of whack. It doesn't mean that. But you set up a schedule for yourself, a time for yourself that would be set aside for meditation. Set up something you can do, not something that you dream of doing, but something that you can do right now. Three times a week, you know, twice a day, whatever it is. But probably nothing too aggressive. And you set that up and then you do that. That's why it's wonderful to have a place like this, where I would assume you have a regular schedule of some sort here. And I would say make use of that. Pick a time there and times when it's available here in as a community. Set out that time for yourself and then do that. People all the time when I give meditation instruction, the most common question I get, well, how much should we meditate? And that's not so important. It's not a matter of how much, it's not a matter of quantity. More a matter of quality, and that you treat this with some kind of respect, and that you will take it up and you're serious about it. You're going to do this, and so you set that regularity in your schedule, in your practice, and then what it means then is that you carry this out whether or not you feel like it, and this is very important. Many times, maybe, you know, even now, I mean, I've been doing this now for 40 years, and even now sometimes, though it's been maybe over 30 years, or about 30 years. In fact, I can tell you exactly when it was January 1977, I finally learned to just do this without kicking and screaming. And, you know, so when the alarm goes off in the morning, you get up, at least for me now, I get up and meditate. It's time for meditation. Some mornings I don't feel like it. Even now, there's some mornings I don't feel like it. But I've learned long ago that you just go ahead anyway. It has nothing to do with whether or not you want to do this or not. You've got to take this up and take it up for the long run, take it up for life. And so you do that with this regularity. Well, of course, once in a while, some unexpected occurrence happens, something you know, some emergency, a family emergency of some sort, any number of things, or you're ill, you're sick, and you can't, well, that's perfectly fine. That's not the same thing as having this flopping mind that just, well, I don't feel like it today. So if you want to take this up for life, you just take that up no matter what you're telling yourself about this. You've set this schedule, and now you just go ahead and do that. And if you do that, if you learn to do that, you will find a great freedom in that. Far from that being some kind of a constricting thing in your life, oh, now I've got to do my meditation. When we finally have the mind that can take this up without screaming and hollering about it, but we just go ahead and do it. There's a great deal of freedom in this. Because there's all kinds of things that come along in your life that you don't want. You wish it wasn't happening now, or things that you do want, they aren't. It's not happening, and very easily our mind can start to flop around regarding all of these sorts of things. And we're constantly disturbed and tossed away. But if you have learned to set out this practice and cultivate a mind that will just go ahead and do this no matter what kind of disturbances might be occurring within the mind from time to time, what we learn is a great deal of freedom. And the freedom I'm speaking of is freedom, what can I say, freedom from your own mind. Freedom from this desiring mind, this craving mind, this wanting mind, this mind that is looking for something useful or fun or helpful or whatever. It's an enslaving mind, and it's a disturbed mind. So I'm taking up this practice then for no reason. It's just useless. We're not doing it for any reason, but we just go ahead and do it. We will discover a kind of mind that is not our ordinary mind, that has great strength and power to just deal with whatever it is that is coming up. To be, it's not really to deal with it, there's nothing really to deal with, but just to be here and to be present with it without flopping about. So that's the first important thing. Another thing is important to remember in meditation is, if you can, and you have a community here, to sit with others. Very important. As much as possible. See if you can set that up for yourself as well. And you're lucky, those of you know, if you're members here, or whatever your arrangement is, I'm not really familiar with it, but it's great that you have a place like this where you can come together as a community to sit. And even if you have a practice at home or something of that sort, periodically at least, or on a regular basis of some sort, to come together with others and to sit is very important for you. It gives you the kind of encouragement to help you maintain this ongoing regular practice for life. And that's very helpful. And it's helpful in other sorts of ways as well. And the third thing that I always want to point out about meditation is that in settling down with this meditation, as I pointed out to my students, we learn to watch our mind in such a way that we're watching for judgment, for naming things, for qualifying things, judging our meditation thoughts like, well, boy, that was a great sit I had there. That was really good. It was so wonderful for me. I haven't sat like that in a week now. That was a good one. Or we might think, I just can't get the hang of this. I don't know how to do this. We'll have all kinds of thoughts like this, judging and qualifying and explaining our meditation to ourselves. You want to let that go. Recognize what you're doing there, because in that judgmental mind, it becomes a brittle mind, and a mind that actually isn't present. It is a mind caught up in kind of fantasy or kind of thinking, a storyline you're making up about your meditation. But it's also a kind of mind that you carry over into all sorts of other things. About yourself, you judge yourself in various ways. You judge the situation. You judge other people. And it becomes our normal mind is a very, when we allow that to take place, it becomes very brittle and sensitive and easily hurt and offended and bothered and disturbed. So in this practice of meditation that we take up together with others and for life, we also learn, what I learned from my teacher and what I try to pass along to my students, is to start noticing what you're doing with your mind. This constant kind of jabbering to yourself, explaining what things are. You don't need to explain. It's besides the meditation that is useless, that we don't use for anything. It's just simply to be here. It's not to sit here and to talk to yourself. if you are talking to yourself, I mean, very normally, naturally the mind, you know, coughs up things, starts chewing on things, and that sort of thing. That's pretty normal. But we learn to just recognize that. We don't judge it. We don't say that's bad. Oh, I should stop. We just realize that that's happening. And now just see if you can let that go. Because if we start to notice this sort of thing, we start to notice just a kind of the ramblings of the mind. If we're really paying attention to what we're doing there, that starts to become kind of sickening after a while. And when we realize that, it's easier now to let that go. And gradually, you can find a more quiet mind, a settled mind, a tolerant mind, a magnanimous mind, a flexible mind, an open mind. And that's what we can call the Vedic meditation. If we are doing a meditation where we aren't seeking gain and trying to get anything from this. So that's what we call useless meditation. It has those kinds of qualities or characteristics about it. Okay, well, maybe that's all I'm going to say on that, but maybe you have some questions. Yes?
Okay, I'm probably going to show how much I don't understand right off the bat here, but here goes anyway. You began by telling us that meditation is useless. And then it seemed to me that everything you said after that was illustrating to us the usefulness, quote, mm-hmm. of meditation for us, the freedom of the mind, being able to notice the jabbering and the, all of that. So is the uselessness in just not approaching it with a goal mm-hmm. to anything?
Yeah.
That's or is it truly useless?
it is useless. Yeah, it truly
because
is.
Because it doesn't seem useless if actually these things will happen.
Well, if you say, well, I want freedom of mind.
Okay.
If I do that, I'll have it. It sounds like okay. But see, the moment you do that, you've just framed everything up, and now you're not going to find that freedom. So we let it go.
It's a hard thing to know that these things can happen if we meditate regularly, but to never approach meditation with, oh yeah, this is going to happen. That's
yeah, but
sure hard thing to do.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I agree. That takes a long time. Well, not a long time, but a few years probably. 10. But yeah, these are very subtle things, and what the meditation is finally, the meditation I'm speaking of here now, that, yeah, you might find relaxation in it. You probably will eventually. Any number of beneficial things. But to the extent that you go looking for these things, the mind you're using to do that is a greedy, grasping mind. It is not the mind of awakening. It is not the mind of it's not the mind of meditation. And so you just set all those things aside. This mind of freedom, this mind of magnanimity, all that, we just set that aside, because you can't go after those things. And it's, Lanza del Vasto, I don't know if any of you are familiar with him, he's an interesting fellow. He was a kind of a wealthy, raised to wealth, and he was a playboy, and he was a handsome-looking guy, and wine, women, song, the whole thing, driving around in fast sports cars, all of this. He had it all. And one day, while he was still fairly young, he realized that, this is not quite giving him what he thought he wanted. And he went to India. And his first day in India, he was robbed, and everything was taken, his passport, everything, his money. He had no way to show who he was, whatever. Anyway, eventually he ran into Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, and became a disciple of his. And very interesting fellow. He wrote a book called Return to the Source, which I would recommend. I read it many years ago now, but interesting fellow. Anyway, but what he said about this matter, about pleasure, because he was a pleasure seeker at one time, and he lived for that. until he realized that he wasn't finding truly anything deep and lasting. True was beyond pleasure. Pleasure wasn't dead, and that's what he realized finally. And he said, pleasure itself teaches us, you know, that it is not something to seek, because when you seek it, he says, it runs from you. But if you just stop, he said, it'll come to overtake you in a way, but it is something quite different from what it was that you thought you were going after. And so it's kind of like you just set that aside, you're not even really concerned for such things as that. And you will find it then. Well, it finds you, maybe is the way to put it. And that's the kind of mind that this meditation I'm speaking of, we cultivate this. And it is subtle. It is something that needs to be pointed out to us, probably repeatedly. It certainly was for me. Fortunately, I had a teacher who didn't let us go too long before reminding us once again. Notice your greedy, grasping mind, and realize that he didn't talk about Lanza de Vasto, but I was already familiar with that guy, but I used to think of what he would say about that. Yeah, you go after things and it will run from you. So most of us end up spending so much of our time, you know, chasing after things. Either we don't know anything like this and we just, you know, pleasure seekers is all right, or we start to take up the meditation with the idea that I want something a little bit more grounded, substantial, real. And we'll take up meditation in that same way without really realizing what we're doing. And yeah, you'll find these things to some degree, but to really cultivate this and to really realize it thoroughly, it's viscerally, at some point we have to understand what it is that we're doing here. We have to understand that grasping mind. And just don't let it have the upper hand. Don't judge it or condemn it. It's there. You have to admit it. You have to, you know, can't fight with it. But once you start to see what it's doing, you don't have to activate it. Yes?
I was interested in that date and time in 1977 when you sort of gave up and said, this is what I'll be doing.
Well, I didn't say anything. It just suddenly stopped, but I recognized it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I can kind of relate to that because I've been, you know, meditating off and on for years, and then all of a sudden, fairly recently in the last year or so, I sort of surrendered to it and said, you know, this is really working, but useless. Useless in a good way. But it was almost like it was almost like I sort of said, okay.
Well, the real refuge is even beyond you, though. When there's no concern at all for self, then the real refuge is found.
I'm not there yet.
Yeah. That's a real subtlety. But I would encourage you just to stay with that and just to look at that. Because it's when that self keeps coming back into the picture, as soon as there's self, there's still some grasping going on. And this is what we have to, and all you need to do is to recognize that. And the more familiar we become with that, the less power it has. And eventually, it can just drop away. So I would just stay with that. Yeah.
I read a long time ago a book by Thich Nhat Hanh, and there was this, the thing I've remembered from it ever since was he said, when doing the dishes, just simply do the dishes. And when I read that at the time, I realized immediately that, you know, there's no activity that I do where I'm just in that activity, constantly thinking about things and, you know, thinking about the next thing and the big dreams and everything that was going to unfold in my life. Some years later, you know, I finally comprehend sort of the meaning of that statement. But I understand that approach and that practice is important in Zen. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, we have, there's a Zen koan, of Joshu Zen Master, very famous Zen Master. And one day a young monk came to him, wanted to enter his monastery. And he says, "I've just arrived." He said, "Please teach me." So Joshu said, "Have you eaten?" And he said, "Yes, I've eaten." And Joshu said, "Well, then wash your bowls." And so it's just as simple as that. And so when you do the dishes, or whatever it is, you're just doing that for its own sake. And also these things, if you're not doing it for some other purpose, then everything, you know, falls into its proper place at the proper time. And we just, when you're there with it and present with it, then we can just completely, I don't even want to say engage these things, we become these things. So like when you're, you've eaten, now just washing the bowls, it's not like, oh, I must wash my bowls, or I should wash my bowls, or a good monk would wash his bowls, or it certainly isn't things like, oh gosh, now I gotta wash my bowls. You know, it's just without saying anything, without thinking anything, the next activity. You've eaten, now wash the bowls, without a word, without a thought, completely engaged in that. And it is the water, it is the sound of the water, it is the swoosh in the bowl, whatever is taking place there. Just fully engaged in that. And at every activity of that, drying the bowl, setting it aside, and all of that. And with that, we just live our life from moment to moment. And completely, more than engaged, we are that. Because that is what you are. We tend to think that, well, I am my body, or I am my mind, or some aspect of my mind, or my emotions, or something like this. We are this that is happening here now. And that is our life. And our life is, we can't separate it out from the rest of the world and everything that is taking place. So to do this with no purpose, then with no sense of gain, is just to take up this moment and what needs to be done in this moment. We're present with what needs to be done, and we can do what needs to be done in this moment. And that actually is meditation. That would be Sun Zen, as Dogen spoke of it, carrying it out perfectly. Of course, I don't know anybody who can carry this out perfectly. I can't. But that's beside the point. It is my interest, my desire. This is what I want to do. This is what I bring myself back to moment by moment as best I can. And that's what we need to do. If we do that, we live a very easy life. That way. No matter what's coming along. Loss, death, injury, things come along. And a very dear friend of mine, lifelong friend of mine, was now very seriously ill, and just got the call. And but these things happen, and we can be tossed away by this, and feel all kinds of agony or whatever. Or we can be here present with it. We can still feel it, completely. And we can live with it entirely. If we completely engage ourselves in the moment, we don't have to be tossed away by such things, because this is life. This is what it presents. It doesn't always give us the wonderful stuff. I'll take up this meditation because I think I'll get some good things from it. But that's not life. Well, sure, maybe some good things, and then some things that maybe don't strike you as being quite so good. But whatever it is that is coming up moment to moment, we can learn to be that and not to be tossed away by that. Things that might make us sad, like now I'm sad when I think of my friend and I'm concerned about him. These are only natural things. But to want to fight that or to resist it or become angry, this is not really to be here. It's not to really live that out. What do we think this is? Such things don't happen. No, this is life. This is human life. And now we can learn to live without kicking and screaming. So that's this practice of meditation allows us to live this out. So I don't know, I probably went way beyond your question. You had a question?
No, I was just wondering, in your practice, as the years have gone by, we've gotten much more technologically sophisticated, and it's certainly something that I have struggled with, how to balance the fast pace that I've heard a lot in the last years. So could you just say how, what do you do with technology, or Facebook, or...
No, I
don't. How is that for you? How it can find place for that in your practice? Or maybe you don't.
Well, I've heard of Facebook, but I don't know what it is. I only had a dial-up internet service up until a few weeks ago. But the center where I'm at, they finally got me set up with, they thought I should get into the 21st century, I guess, so. And we now have the high-speed stuff. But I still don't, I don't use that much, So I get my emails and things like that, and I've Googled once in a while. I even did that with my old setup. But some of this other stuff, Facebook, I don't know what that is. And I don't think I want to get involved, whatever it is. Now, I've heard, what other things, Twitter or something, I don't even know what that is, but I just don't, get involved with that much. I try to work it in such a way that I don't get as much as I might otherwise, I don't do anything over the internet, I'll get letters from students and things like that. But I work out arrangements with certain ones that can't be here, like elsewhere. I work at that in such a way where I just don't, get caught up with that too much. But I use the computer every day. I write. Right now I'm working on a couple of books, actually. So I spend a lot of time writing. But I don't need the internet for that. So I'm sorry. We have a website at our center, but then we also have a webmaster, and he takes care of that kind of stuff.
To expand on that a little bit, the 24/7 news cycle that we're all exposed to in our work. Constantly rushed through and exposed to CNN and ESPN. I guess the answer you're going to give me is just turn it all off. Just ignore it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think so. Depends. I mean, if you want to live out of awakeness, I would say yes. But because to the degree to which we allow ourselves to become distracted by all of this, stuff. To that degree, we're not present. We think we live in this information age, and we somehow think information provides us with knowledge. It doesn't. And if you want knowledge, then you're going to have to seek wisdom. And if you seek wisdom, that's quite different than having access to a lot of information. If you learn to make yourself still and quiet, what it is you'll discover is that you already know. You know the reality. You already know the truth. You can't get this through acquiring a bunch of information. That might give you a handle on a lot of conceptual knowledge, which might be functional and useful. Maybe you need that to some degree. So, depending on how much you might need to engage in this sort of thing. But I would be very careful with that sort of thing. And don't let that eat away this your time to be settled and to be quiet and to be here and to be watching this greedy mind that otherwise is constantly trying to grasp. That information age is continuously feeding that grasping mind. Yeah, are we out of time?
Oh, I'm okay.
I just wanted to follow up on this because you spoke of all these things happening as being distraction. Is it not possible that we can look at these things and call it being mindful of what's happening? And I would go then ask you, and I don't mean...
You don't need to look at all those things to be mindful of what's happening.
Let me just ask you, then I don't mean to, push you on the spot, but if you don't get involved a little bit, how did you know who to vote for, or did you just not vote? What would happen if somebody were going to build a rail yard right next to your meditation center, but you have not read the news or involved the news to know that?
Oh, I think by the time they would build a railroad yard next to our meditation center, they would inform us. They don't just come in and start tearing up the ground next door, I'm not saying that we need to cut ourselves off. But I'm just saying to be very careful of these sorts of things, because this stuff is so seductive, and we're easily taken by that. And you have to understand that the life of meditation is not a life of Googling and what is it, YouTubing and Facebooking and all those kinds of things. I don't know what they are, but it's not that kind of stuff. And so you take a look at that, and to what degree do you need those sorts of things, And like in my writing, once in a while, now that I've kind of caught on to what Google is, I was working on something. I wanted to know if there was a standard way of doing footnotes in terms of the symbols and what order they put them in, that sort of thing. So I Googled, footnote order or something, or footnote symbols, I think is what I, And so I got some information, and that was very handy, because I didn't have to go to the library and whatever. So, once in a while. But you want to be careful, because the next thing you know, you're caught. And a lot of these things, I suspect, are designed in such a way just to keep you, getting caught in more and more. And so I would say it's your best to, it's kind of like when you go shopping, they say, you go grocery shopping, you have a list, and you get what's on the list, and then you check out and you go home, that sort of thing, as opposed to, of course, they'll set the stores, so you stroll through and, this looks good, and you start, so you just want to, watch for that. That's all I'm saying. But as for, the information that you need to vote and that sort of thing, I think that's very important. And you can find that. But you can do that in a kind of a sane way. You don't have to become a 24-hour news junkie, that sort of thing. So. Yes?
This isn't my question, but I think what's breaking down is, if it's possible to be mindful doing the dishes, is it possible to be mindful, on the internet?
Probably not. Let's put it this way. It would be very, it's much more difficult, I would say. And there's something about just the tube there, the screen, even like with television too. You notice how, you walk into a room, a TV is on, and it just keeps drying. And if you just turn that off, of course, there's also the television of your mind. Sometimes I talk to people about this. You're sitting here, and in your mind it's just going a mile a minute, and you're thinking, you're actually hearing sounds, and you're feeling things, and whatever, even though you're sitting in a quiet room. You can just go over and turn off that TV. But if you are in a room with a TV, try that sometime. It's noisy, it's distracting. Turn off the TV. There's some bird outside the window. You can hear the breeze. It changes things.
Well, my question is this: how does Zen practice lead to compassion? I know it's a huge topic, but I'm just, I don't know if you're encapsulating this or.
Well, I don't know that it does lead to compassion. I wouldn't put it that way, that this practice is compassion. This practice to sit in this way is, in the way that I said, sanzen, as Dogen would speak of it. Not as we might wish to do or as we're trying to do, that sort of thing, but when we finally, a moment, and it's like I said, I can't do this perfectly and sustain it moment by moment, so I'm not talking about something like this. But there is this being present. We can find that. We might slip off now and then, but my teacher used to say the measure of your practice is how quickly can you get back on, you know, the path here. And when we're present with this, that is sitting out of, there's wisdom and compassion coming out of that, because that very sitting is the understanding, is the knowledge, is the knowing of just this moment. And with that is the compassion. And out of that, when action needs to take place, it's coming out of that understanding, out of that wisdom. That is what the compassion is the action that's coming from a mind that is totally present. So it's not that it leads to that, it is that. And so we come to that, we bring ourselves back to that, and we'll find it. Yes?
I really like the way you talked about the uselessness, because for me, I'm trying to kind of apply that mentality to being in school full time right now, because it's like so everybody's so focused on what they're going to be when they get out and what kind of career they're going to get. And when I was in that mindset, I was just suffering so much emotionally that I lost myself in that future concept of what I would be. And now being back in school after taking some time off, doing a lot of practice, you know, in the midst of chaos and full time, and, you know, my classes, I'm a graphic design student, so I'm on a computer for 9 hours straight when I'm in class. It's easy to lose that moment, the present moment mentality. And for me, just keeping in mind that this doesn't define me. If I get through school and nothing changes, can this be okay? There's a great freedom in that, knowing that I don't have to put so much pressure on this product that I'm going to be, because everything that I am is happening right now in front of me.
Yeah, you learn to take care of this moment, and that's taking care of the future as well. So when you're in the class or whatever it is that you're engaged in the moment, just be there totally with it, focused on that completely. And you'll take care of all those switches. You don't need to be thinking about those. My teacher gave this example one time. He said, you want to be an artist, you're like a painter. And he said, there's two ways of going about this. You can either be focused on becoming the greatest artist in the world, you know. People look up to you and praise you and all that, you know, that's what you're after. Or, he said, you can forget yourself and devote your life to art. And one of them is going to be far more rewarding and fun and easy and relaxed and settled and with knowledge, a deep knowledge of what art is, or even just the tactile, you know, feel of putting the brush to the canvas or whatever kind of artist you might be. But this is something worth settling down and contemplating for just a little bit. I think very quickly we can see what the difference is between these two things. And then I would say to see if you can have the courage and the strength to just go ahead and do what is obviously the most present and together way of taking this up, as opposed to being sidetracked by what everyone else is doing or what they think they must do to further their career or this sort of thing. I was once there with, early on as a young man and pursuing all the different things. But at some point I realized the agony of living in that way and accepting something a little bit more down there, just here, just taking care of this moment here. And out of that, we can find a truly happy and peaceful life with both heart and wisdom. So that's what I would, I would just encourage you to stay with that. Yes.
Talk about meditation and Buddhism in the United States and in the Twin Cities. So many of my Dharma friends read, whether it's Zen or Vipassana or Tibetan, all over, and just interested in what you think are the challenges and the benefits of doing that. And then the second part is, some of my friends are so amazed at how many opportunities there are here in the Twin Cities for meditation compared to other cities, and what you thought on how the heck that happened.
I don't know. Being a native Minnesotan, I guess I think it's because Minnesota is such a great place. Of course we would have. I don't know. I have no idea. In the case of Zen, it was Katagiri Roshi came here, and that was my teacher. And so he has a number of Dharma heirs, that have started centers here. I believe there's four of us anyway, I think. I should know, shouldn't I? But there's also some, close by. So that takes care of a good portion of the Zen, portion of that. But as for the other things, why there's a large Tibetan community here, I don't know. And, I don't know. I wouldn't know how to answer that, actually.
And what about the first part, talking about kind of the cross-reading that seems to be happening with a lot of the readings that people are doing? And is that, are there some problems with that, or challenges, or are there only benefits?
Well, I don't know if there's much in the way of benefit at all, really. I'd be very careful of becoming kind of a dabbler. And just kind of sampling a little bit of this and sampling a little bit. What are you doing? Just settle down and find a way and take that up and do that. And don't keep sampling other, because that's another form of distraction. And so I don't know if you find much. I don't know what benefit would be. As I was saying before, this whole thing, I don't even say there's benefit in this meditation that I teach. That's not the way to approach this, so that's part of that same kind of mind. Well, I want to get this, so I'll take a little bit of that, and I'll take a little bit of this, and take a little bit. But what kind of a mind is acting in this way? I'd say it's a distracted mind, a confused mind. It's a mind that's trying to be, please itself in some way, or feeling, I want to make sure I get that good thing over here, and I want to get this good thing over here. I would say find one of these. If you find something that it sings to you, then pursue that. Go into that thoroughly. So just settle down and go into something deeply rather than sampling the surface. You know what I'm saying? So that's what I would say there. And as for benefit, I don't know what kind of benefit, what would we call benefit? Is it just simply to be awake? We won't find that awakeness by carrying on in that usual way, which is, I'm going to try a little bit of this, try a little bit of that. So I would say, in any one of these traditions, you'll find where people have gone deeply and they've pointed out the way. And so I would say, take one of them up and do that. So go deep. Think in terms of quality and depth and settledness, and not in terms of sweeping across the surface, making sure you get this or that. Just watch for those kinds of things. That's what I would say. Yes.
How do you handle physical pain, joint issues?
That couldn't be a problem. Well, first of all, I used to have a lot of pain in my meditation early on, and I still have pain, but it's not a problem anymore. But first of all, you want to be, you know, kind to yourself. Don't overdo it. But I would say the first thing I do when I have a student that has a problem with pain, the first thing I want to do is look at their posture. And maybe they're sitting in some way that isn't, you know, that might be giving some trouble. So you want to just, you know, kind of look at these kinds of things. And I always, the thing you want to find in your posture is you want stability, and you want, you know, to be in some kind of a, you know, upright. I mean, we're very stable if you're lying down on the floor or the table or the bed or whatever. But now your mind is going to become, you know, kind of groggy. So we want to be alert, okay? We want to get into a posture then that allows us to, you know, to sit upright and to be alert. But at the same time, then we also might start encountering some of the. At the same time, say we want to be stable, but at this, we might also be encountering, you know, some difficulty with pain at that point. So, but bearing in mind these two things, both to be, you know, in an alert posture and yet at the same time a stable one. Now, see if you can, you know, find a way to deal with that pain as best you can. And then beyond that, you might not be able to eliminate it completely. I never was able to do that. But so you want to minimize that if you can. But then beyond that, you don't be bothered by it. But I would also say make sure you're not doing something injurious to yourself. And because sometimes the pain could be an indication you're doing something along those lines. But even if you're not, you can still have pain. And so I would say after minimizing, do what you can to minimize that. Then I would say just stay with it. And you can even use the pain as a kind of a focus of your meditation. And, you know, just settle into that a bit. A great deal of what we experience as pain is our resistance to it and our fear of it. And if you push on that a little bit, first of all, you do what you can to take care of it. But then if you can't take care of it completely, just push on that gently. Don't hurt yourself. But just resist that. Push against that a little bit and see what happens. That's what I would say. But if I had a student like this, I would continue to work with them then at that point. And so it's hard for me now in a general audience like this to give a general approach of what would follow from this, because it would all depend on what we're being met with here. But basically that, minimize it if you can. Try not to be too fearful of it. And look at it. See what it is. I suspect that the reason I don't have a problem with pain now is I suspect it might not be because I have less pain than I used to. I mean, I'm an older, you know, I'm in my 60s now. I used to have trouble when I had pain when I was in my 20s. You know, you'd think maybe a 20-year-old ought to be able to. Of course, you can now say, well, I've gotten used to it, or I've gotten used to sitting this way and all that sort of thing. But it's hard for me to know exactly, you know, what that is. But I sit now with a much different mind than I had then. And I know that as a young man, when I had a lot of trouble with pain, I was always fighting it. And I was afraid of it, and I resisted it. And I suspect an awful lot of what was giving me trouble was coming just out of that alone. I don't fight with it anymore. And it's not a problem.
You just mentioned.
Yes.
You said meditate on the pain or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think of something, which is sometimes when in my busy day there's something agitating me, bugging me, giving me stress or whatever, sometimes I think I'm going to meditate on that when I get there. I sit down. And, but now it kind of sounds like it's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't chase after anything or to pursue anything. But when things come up to you, you know, in your meditation, be aware of that. You know, just notice that. But more than that, also notice your own mind, you know, and your reaction to that. And I would also say let it go. Allow that to change and drift away, because it will. So I wouldn't take up a real active interest in it. Just you know, it'll probably solve itself if you don't try to grasp it. And as a writer, you know, many times I get the old writer's block, right? Because I'm working on something and I have a problem. But then later on in the day, once a day at least, I try to go for a walk. I live near Lake Harriet, so I walk around Lake Harriet most days. And I always carry a little notepad with me then. So it's amazing how, when I'm not thinking about it, when I'm walking, I just walk. I don't spend a lot of time thinking too much while I'm walking. If I am, and if I'm not, I'm not. But it's just in walking and not really working on it too hard. It's amazing how many problems like that, knotty problems that I can't really untangle. You know, they suddenly open up when you're not really, you know. Sometimes people think that they should carry a little notepad with them while they're sitting in meditation. I would discourage that, you know. But when you're not, many times the kind of problems and difficulties that might come up for us, if you're not actually, you know, trying to go after it, you'll resolve it. The reason for this is because in most cases you actually know what you need to do, but it's because we, in trying to grasp it, we frame everything up, and now we kind of eliminate the possibilities that are right there in front of us that we would see. But if you let it go, these things will more easily show up. So in the meditation itself, then when you engage the meditation, again, it just let it be this. Sometimes we talk about this big sky mind, this open sky mind, where we're not really trying to accomplish anything within it. But if you have problems, difficulties in your life of various kinds, these things, more often than not, they will suggest their own solution, you know, if you let them. I'm not quite sure if that answers your question. But, yeah. And you know, how late is it?
Time for one more question.
One more? Okay. Maybe that's it.
Anybody else? You know where to find Steve. You have the question there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.